in the markets, I've seen you in the streets and at your political convention. Talking of your crusade, talking of your nation and other things too terrible to mention. And you proclaim your Christianity, you proclaim your love of God, you talk of apple pie and mom. I've just got one question and I want an answer. Tell me, who would Jesus bomb? Maybe Jesus would bomb the Syrians, 'cause they're not Jews like him. Maybe Jesus would bomb the Afghans on some kind of vengeful whim. Maybe Jesus would drive an M1 tank and he would shoot Saddam. Battleships, I've seen you in the house upon the hill, and I've heard you talking about making the world safer and about all the men you have to kill. And you speak so glibly about your civilization and how you have the moral higher ground, while halfway around the world your explosives smash the buildings. Ah, if you could only hear the sound. But maybe Jesus would sell landmines and turn on his electric chair. Maybe Jesus would show no compassion for his enemies in the lands way over there. Maybe Jesus would have flown the planes that killed the kids in Vietnam. Who would Jesus bomb? Yes, I hear you shout with confidence as you praise the Lord, and you talk about this God you know so well. You talk of Armageddon and your final victory when all the evil forces go to hell. Well, you'd best hope you've chosen wisely on the right side of the Lord, and when you die, your conscience, it is clear. You'd best hope your atom bombs are better than the sword at the time when your reckoning is here. I don't think Jesus would send gunships into Bethlehem or jets to raise the towns of Timorese. I don't think Jesus would lend money to dictators or drive those SUVs. And I don't think Jesus would ever have dropped a single ounce of napalm. So tell me, who would Jesus bomb?
Welcome to the Peace and Justice Report. I'm Tom Walker, and that song, Who Would Jesus Bomb, was written and sung by our guest here today, musician, singer, and songwriter, David Rovix. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Tom. Great to be on your show.
I've listened to you for many years, and I've been a supporter for many years, and as have my partner, Bob Connors, and we're proud to have you on. I want to say first, though, as always, that remember to note that the views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers. And full disclosure to our listeners, I don't want them to think this is live. It's usually live, but this was recorded yesterday, Tuesday, via Zoom, because David lives on the West Coast, in Portland, I believe. My wife was born in Portland, so we kind of know that a little bit, that area. David, though, was born in New York City, and he grew up in Connecticut. He had a brief stint at Earlham College in Indiana, and then moved to Berkeley, California, where he held a series of blue-collar jobs and was, and still is, a member of Industrial Workers of the World, the Wobblies. And we'll talk about that later, maybe. In the early 1990s, he moved to Boston, where he hit the subways with an acoustic guitar and songs of protest. David generally refers to himself as a songwriter or a musician, but he has been more fully described elsewhere as an American acoustic protest singer. And most of your songs are in protest of something or other, and that's for sure accurate. Unlike most recording artists, David makes all of his music available online for free and encourages fans to videotape his concerts. When he performs live, he doesn't use a set list, but lets the concert unfold on its own. He released his first all-original album in 1998 and followed it with several more, including the one we just played, "Who Would Jesus Bomb?" And David, of which I've always wondered, David now lives in Portland, Oregon, with his wife and daughter, and he writes for Counterpunch and Truth Out. So, David, welcome, and please talk more about your life, how you came to be a songwriter and performer.
Sure. I mean, my parents are both classical musicians, so I did not fall far from the tree as
What
far as that goes.
instruments? What are they playing?
They're both pianists and my
Wow.
and organists, and my father is also a composer.
Wow.
So I grew up around composition and classical music and contemporary classical and what they call concert music or 12-tonal music.
Wow.
And so I never got into the 12-tonal stuff or really much into the classical stuff, but I started playing music as a kid, and I got into folk music and rock and roll and different kinds of non-classical forms of music as a teenager, and have continued my interest in music ever since.
Who were your main influences as you were growing up, or even as an adult? Phil Oakes, Pete Seeger, who were the greats that influenced you?
As a kid, it was there was a relatively obscure musician named Al Giordano when I was 12, who went on to become a fairly prominent journalist in some circles. Lived in for a long time in Mexico, died young not long ago, but he was the 21-year-old sort of adult around the campfire singing protest songs when I was 12 in 1979, and had a tremendous impact. And then later, I discovered Pete Seeger and Woody Guthrie, and went to a festival where a friend, older friend, turned me on to Phil Oakes. And then from Phil Oakes, I kind of discovered all sorts of other stuff from there. It was a bit of a, can of worms at that point,
I noticed one mentioned elsewhere I saw on the web, Jim Page. I don't know him, or Rob Johnson of
Oh,
England.
there's so many. Yeah, Jim Page. I mean, of course, yeah, Phil Oakes would have been one of the earliest discoveries along with Pete Seeger. But then when I first went out to the West Coast and then hitchhiked up to Seattle, pretty much the first thing I did was go to the Pike Place Market. And then hearing Jim Page was just a life-altering experience. I mean, I really never had until then, I didn't know that there was anybody this good writing songs about what was happening. Everything I had heard up till then was people that were had been sort of more well known 20 years before, and here was a guy who was right here in flesh and blood, singing about what was happening. And yeah, and then Rob Johnson was another one of those discoveries. And they're both still going, both still fantastically productive,
Wow.
brilliant songwriters.
So you've always been interested in music about, like you said, what's happening now, as opposed to 40. Well, you write some historical songs, but your concern is what's happening right now. That's
Oh,
interesting.
no, I'm big interested in history. I was just saying that what I when I was like in the 80s, when I was sort of discovering these people, it was 20 years after the period during which folk, sort of politically oriented folk music was fashionable. It was the record industry was promoting it. So people of people of all ages still today, including young people, but people certainly of older generations, everybody, they all associate politically oriented sort of folk music with the early 1960s, you know, because that's when it was like promoted. And by the way, I mean, that's when the record industry briefly decided that this was good and stuff, you know. But it existed before then and has existed since then. But that's the period people associated with, you know. But so, and that's what I first discovered too. I mean, when in the 80s, when I was looking into this stuff, you know, the first stuff that comes up, I mean, you go to a record store, you know, back when everybody was getting rid of their vinyl records, I'd go to record stores and, you know, find Phil Oakes, Tom Paxton, Buffy St. Marie, you know, all this stuff from the early 60s, and I loved it, you know, but you wouldn't run into a Jim Page record in one of those record stores, you know. I mean, people didn't have them in the first place, you know. But, you know, so the more contemporary artists you had to discover through more roundabout means than just, you know, going to a record store like Jim Page, you know. I mean, you wouldn't discover him unless you were living in Seattle or Ireland. I mean, because Christy Moore recorded some of his songs. Christy Moore, the sort of Pete Seeger of Ireland, you could say. You know, so Jim Page is well known in Ireland, but outside of Ireland and Seattle, he's not terribly well known, but he's, you know, just brilliant. And Rob Johnson, another one. I mean, a lot of people in the folk scene in England are familiar with Rob and love Rob, but outside of the British folk music scene, he's not well known, but he's one of the best songwriters alive today.
We're going to talk about folk music and its gradual decline in the American scene and its place all over the world. But one thing that occurred to me was a question: Why do humans love music so much? What does it do to them as opposed to speech? And why do even whales and other animals sing to each other? What is different? Why is it a part of our brain? Or have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, I think about it a lot, and it's because it's really, it gets to the heart of why I do what I do, and why, you know, why so many other artists are so obsessive about doing, about communicating through those means, you know, because it is such a powerful means of communication. And scientists not long ago, maybe a decade ago, did a brain study where they found something that wouldn't surprise any musicians anywhere on the planet, that when you sing words, they go right to the emotional centers of the brain. So they get processed differently. And, you know, we all knew that already, you know, but now that, and that's been proven, you know, and because, it's telling a story through singing a song is probably in the space of 3 minutes. I don't know if there's a more powerful form of communication. If you're trying to convey, get across to people what's happening somewhere, or try to convey the basic essence of a historical event, you know, and what it felt like, you know. I don't think you can convey that any better than you can with a song, unless maybe a music video, you know, that could be even better, you know, because then you can use the visual element to communicate too.
Well, when they, even old people, when they start to lose their facility for speech, when you sing to them in the nursing home, they light up. Something, it's a different part of the brain. It's like you said, it's an emotional thing. And I'm glad we have song. You also talked about music all over the world, and it seems like there's less live music. I think you pointed out there's less live music these days at protests, rallies, or elsewhere. Why is that? And what is it? The sound system? Is it the venue? Is it just style and fashion? What's fashionable? I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, what I notice traveling around different countries, and I don't travel that extensively, but there's like a couple dozen countries that I travel in pretty often, and it's a really a particular problem in the United States, but it's also in what I call the Anglosphere, like which I mean the US, Britain, Australia, New Zealand, and In this particular instance, Ireland would not be included because Ireland hasn't lost Ireland. In Ireland, they still understand the value of music, which would be shocking if that were not the case. But it's shocking that it's been lost here. I mean, this country is home to so many musical styles that have just had such a tremendous impact in the world, it would be impossible to overstate. And, you know, I mean, how important music was to social movements during times like the 1960s, the 1930s, and the 19-teens, in different contexts, you know, music was at the very heart of those movements, of the, you know, the anti-war movement in the 60s, the civil rights movement, the 30s movement of, you know, of workers, the unemployed, the union movement, the Communist Party. Music was all over that scene. In the early 20th century with the industrial workers of the world, music was at the very heart of their methods of organizing and educating and inspiring the people. You know, the power of music in the 60s, I think, was, I mean, you know, through all these periods, through all these social movements, you know, people, it's one of the things that was really consistent among all these periods and these social movements, that all the ones that I've just mentioned, is the FBI. And, you know, J. Edgar Hoover was alive for all of that. And, you know, J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI, which has not changed since he died. But the FBI was very aware of the power of music and culture within all of these movements. And the FBI is on record, extensively on record. This is nothing at all conspiratorial, although, of course, as soon as you mention the FBI, people are thinking, oh, who is this conspiracy theorist? This is all a matter of the public record, thanks to the revealing of the COINTELPRO papers during when the Citizens Commission to Investigate the FBI raided the FBI offices in 1971 in Media, Pennsylvania, and liberated 1,000 secret documents, that extensively documented the FBI's efforts to destroy the left in the United States, from the industrial workers of the world to the Communist Party to the civil rights movement to the anti-war movement, SDS. And one of the things that they would always be doing was figuring out what were the cultural hinge, what's the hinge sort of for the linchpin, what hinges people together culturally, and try to disrupt that, you know. And the FBI realized a long time ago, specifically in the 1960s, that that you can't let the left have the culture. You can't let that happen. You have to keep them separated from each other. And I don't have, you know, any kind of extensive, you know, evidence to present for, like, to explain just what the FBI has been doing all this time to separate the political activists from the cultural scene. But it's happened anyway. However it happened, it has happened. And it is just an abomination. It's just shocking. It's just incredible. Hard to believe that there could possibly be political activists out there who don't understand the central value of culture and music and, you know, in the context of social movements. I mean, it's you know, here we are. You never have music, live music at protests in this country, and that's been true for over 10 years now.
We have a lot of music. Oh, by the way, Ireland, I agree with you about Ireland. I sent you the material on that folk music tour of Ireland. I said, amazing. Every pub, every night has four or five, six, seven, 10 players trying to play, playing their own songs, playing other songs. And it's alive, a real culture in Ireland, which I really appreciate. I've gone twice to the West Coast to hear that. It's amazing. And they love it, of course. Okay, so we have less live music, but some of it was discouraged, I guess, by the FBI, and we don't have as much today. But, you know, we do have live music here at Fogartyville three, four, five times a week. folk and Cuban and hip hop, everything, but not so much protest music that I can remember. So next time you're touring the South Coast of the United States, I want you to get in touch with me, and we'll get in touch with the manager of our. We have a live music venue that seats 125 people. It's a listening room. Nobody talks. It's a beautiful place. Good cameras. Good sound system. So we still do it, but not so much protest. Then again, I don't go every night, so I don't know. But not as much protest songs. That's for sure. And by the way, we're talking to the singer and songwriter David Rovics, and his website is David Rovics. .com. So one thing I wondered, I've always loved your music. One thing I wondered about your songs in particular, you have kind of a unique spoken style. It creates to me an urgency. It's not about Puff the Magic Dragon or anything. It's about real things, about real events. And because you speak almost, you don't speak, you sing the words, but it creates an intimacy with the listener that I don't find in other performers. I feel like you're talking to me, you're telling me a story, and a lot of your songs are historical, of course. So talk more about that, your style. Did you come up with that on your own, or is that just the way it occurs to you, or what?
That's there. I think when I was first getting into the sort of the open mic scene and the sort of singer songwriter scene in the 80s, that's when I discovered like microphone technique. And in Boston, I mean Boston, where I was living for many years, there's a lot of great. It's a great place for street music still today, and that's largely because of the street artists' guild suing the city of Boston and the city of Cambridge in the 70s and winning and getting rules in place which do not exist in many cities. I mean, busking street music and it's shocking to people if they ever discover how bad it is to try to be a street musician in a place like San Francisco. Like you can't play on the
Know that.
platforms that you can't play on the platforms of the train stations in San Francisco. You'll get shooed away right away, which is so bizarre given the history of that city when it comes to music. But Boston is a great city for street music. And all the street musicians use sound systems, battery powered sound systems, and that's been true for a long time. And of course, those systems have gotten much better over time. But so in that scene, I encountered just a lot of great performers with microphone technique, and also just in the folk venues like Club Passim. I mean, just learning how to communicate, tell a story in an intimate way. That's what I learned from that crowd, and the speak the talking. It is talking. A lot of the songs, especially on certain albums, I'm just talking and only singing the choruses, and I don't want to call it hip hop. I think it's not, but I am talking, and it is rhythmic, and people can call it whatever they want to. Some hip hop artists have called it hip hop. I don't care what people call it, but it's definitely influenced by hip hop. It's definitely rhythmic speech, and with music underneath, which is also rhythmic, so.
Yeah. I know it's a little John McCutcheon for me is a little like that. He writes about universal things, and I love his albums as well. Not so much protest, but the same intimate style and giving histories and so forth.
Well, John McCutcheon, I mean, I think of myself as very much being in the same mold, in many, in most ways, although he's a better musician and better multi-instrumentalist, but he sings a lot about, he writes a lot of songs about history. And which I do too. Actually, most of the songs I write are probably about historical events, because I think that is the best way to teach about the present, you know, is through history. I mean, in the past couple of years, I've been writing really much more about documenting the genocide in Gaza. And that's, you know, that's what I've been writing about, you know, not so much about history. I love his songs about history. I mean, you know, he's written so many, but the one about the Christmas truce and during World War One is just absolutely tremendous.
It's in the trenches. Yeah.
Yeah, Christmas in the Trenches.
I think that's it. I've seen it done live, and it's just amazing. So we've already established you perform all over the world, and I noticed though you have some upcoming U.S. Concerts in the Northeast in October and in January in California. Is that true? What is something changing?
Well, I have. I used to tour all over the U.S. For many years. I did that. I did a big driving tour all over the U.S. twice a year, in the spring and the fall. And then after a while, I was I was too busy with gigs in Europe, and I started doing one big driving tour around the U.S. and then in the spring or fall, and then the rest of it would be in other countries. About 12 years ago, it started becoming financially impossible to do tours like that in the U.S. for me. For a lot of other musicians as well, because in 2013, especially musicians with a youthful fan base, which is my situation, we lost half our income overnight because Spotify started their free tier. Oh. And when they stopped charging $10 a month for people to use their service, but, you know, you could have access to all the world's music for free. A lot of people just stopped buying CDs completely altogether overnight, which I completely understand. but it meant that, you know, for me and millions of other musicians in the world, suddenly we lost half our income. So that meant drastic changes in how I was doing things. So I've continued to do gigs on the West Coast in the U.S. and in the Northeast, but I hardly ever get to any other part of the country because it's just impossible to make it all work financially.
Yeah, I remember, my daughter's in Berkeley. I go to Freight and Salvage, you know, and okay, so your current focus is on the Middle East, and you sent me some songs to play. Any particular ones you want to play now, or shall we play all of them, or what do you think? I got them all.
Oh, sure. But just play. How about play Gunning Down Little Girls and Boys?
All right. Let's see.
Which has been happening every day on the little areas that the U.S. and Israel have opened up these places to give out boxes of flour and shoot people while they try to get the boxes of flour. That's been happening every day for the past week.
Let me share my screen. Okay, be patient with me here. This is the first time I've done it like this. Here we go.
I'm watching every morning as they wait in line. Instead of dying of starvation, forced to risk their lives for a bag of flour, what remains of the Palestinian nation? Did they pass a resolution in the parliament somewhere? Did they castigate the killers for their crimes? Did they say that sometime soon they might do something too late, just like every other time? Sorry, I can't hear you above the noise of the Israelis gunning down little girls and boys. I'm just listening to the wailing of a million children dying. I'm hearing on NPR and BBC Israeli fascist politicians lying. Meanwhile, someone said something about somewhere. Was it Boulder or Ukraine? Was there something about the Taoiseach?
or the Prime Minister of Spain. Sorry, I can't hear you above the noise of the Israelis gunning down little girls and boys. Hearing protesters who say, bring them home, as they're wrapped in blue and white. What differentiates them, I don't know, from the Holocaust deniers of the right. Perhaps an argument could be made in a time of peace, but this is total war. If you're talking about anything else, then what the hell do you stand for? Sorry, I can't hear you above the noise of the Israelis gunning down little girls and boys. I'm watching every morning as they wait in line instead of dying of starvation, forced to risk their lives for a bag of flour, what remains of the Palestinian nation.
Wow, David.
It's happening every day. And every day, since I wrote that song, I just keep on reposting it, because the next day there's another massacre. What varies is just the numbers killed. But they say we're firing warning shots, and they fire warning shots, and 27 people are dead, and 100 others are wounded, and they've all been shot in the head and the chest and in the back. You know, those are not warning shots.
Children shot in the head is not a warning shot.
No.
No. Well, let's play some more. I mean, that's what you do. We've got 20 minutes. I've got if a song could raise an army, deport the billionaires. That would be one of my favorites. Our current topic, Muhammad Khalil. We could talk about him.
Yeah. Anything. I mean, it's and I just, in another email I sent you this morning is a song I wrote about the recent events in LA, if we want to play something real fresh. But any of those, this last track that we just heard, what's particularly special about that is the haunting vocal harmonies from Laura Love in Seattle. I'm working with some great musicians doing. Of course, many people don't even notice the what's happening behind the guitar and the voice, you know. But that's affecting people in all kinds of ways, whether they're paying attention or not.
Which song was that?
That one we just heard, Gunning Down Little Girls and Boys.
Course,
it's going to be on the upcoming album, and it'll be the first one that includes Laura Love's vocals, along with Chet Gardner's guitar and all sorts of stuff from his studio in Hawaii. He's been doing a lot of remixes of songs I send him, and that's the case with Mahmoud Khalil and Deport the Billionaires as well, which are both from my most recent album that's up on Spotify now, which is Deport the Billionaires.
I don't have them labeled here, but let's
put. Oh, you could just pick a random one.
Yeah, that's right. Here we go. Let's share sound, and then we'll play this one.
Mahmoud Khalil was born a refugee. Last December, he got a master's degree. He was a student at Columbia when the war began. To be expelled and deported had not been the plan. But sometimes you have to step up, and that's what he did. His training started early as a little kid. Growing up in Syria, in a slice of Palestine, exiled by 1949, Mahmoud Khalil spoke
coffin times before. The press who came to cover this protest against the war. The tents which got exactly the attention that they sought to speak out against the destruction our country's policies have wrought. As the bombs kept falling on the children down below, some people had to do something, and the place where they could go was the protest camp. Where people went, and that's where you could find him with the backdrop of tents. Mahmoud Khalil was at home with his pregnant wife when one day came the visit that would change his life. Trump said he'd deport them, and now he's following through. ICE agents came and got him, as they were sent to do, with no uniforms or warrants, just an order for a raid. A week into Israel's complete blockade, they say he supports the resistance, though nothing can be found, aside from horror at the buildings in Gaza collapsing to the ground. Mahmoud Khalil in detention, they're not saying where. For evidence against him, they've not a tweet to share. ICE agents on the campus, what's next nobody knows, with an administration happy whichever way it goes. And silence from the Congress, except for one or two. The leadership apparently thinks it's a fine thing to do to suspend the rule of law in defense of genocide. The future possibilities are open wide. Mahmoud Khalil.
Yeah, he is still in jail. What's the story with Mahmoud?
Yeah, I believe he's been able to send out communications and such through his lawyer, but he is still in detention in Louisiana, I think, is they're still. The government wants to deport him, and his lawyers are going through the legal process to try to keep him in the U.S. In other cases, they've had better luck with getting him let out. It seems to depend on the jurisdiction. So, like, there was that one person who was let out was originally abducted in Vermont. Whereas Khalil was abducted in New York and then immediately shipped to Louisiana. And I'm not sure about the legality of shipping him to Louisiana, but the reason to do that is because they got judges in Louisiana who are more liable to deport people than the ones in Vermont or New Jersey.
Of course, of course. I'm sure you're tempted to go down there and sing with them in L.A. But it seems to be calming down now, and I don't know. Now, following this program right immediately is Amy Goodman, Democracy Now! We have her every day at 10 o'clock. So that's the way I keep up with national and international news. I know you had a beef with her one time. You wanted her to play more songs, not by, what was the distinction?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say I had a beef with her, but I did make the perhaps tactical error of publicly mentioning that 83% of the songs they play in their song breaks, that are, if they're songs in English that they play, 83% of them, according to my study of 110 of their episodes, 83% of the songs they play in their music breaks were number one hits, and majority of them were written by artists from the 20th century who are now dead. And there's nothing wrong with artists that are dead, or hits, but if you're calling yourself an independent news show, right, and you're not playing any independent music, that's a problem. And it's an easy one to fix. Your show will be vastly improved by playing independent music about the stories you're doing, rather than some rehashed old Dylan song again. I love Dylan, but come on, how many times can we play it? 1963 Dylan song,
Well,
to try to illustrate an anti-war, something about a war, I mean, it just gets ridiculous. I don't understand I don't think there's a philosophy involved with their choosing music breaks. It's random. It depends on whatever the producer happens to like. Yeah. There's no thought that goes into it.
Now, so, she's come to town here and spoken with W. WSLR. She's a friend, of course, of the station. But
of course.
Yeah. Let's play one more about the billionaires. This is one of my favorite gripes. Here we go. Let me hit share. And we'll share this sound here.
Something happened.
See, they're criminals, our names came to raise their families, clean houses, drive trucks.
It's not working.
Working in factories, you round them up and take them off in military planes.
It's all sounding like I'm underwater.
Back from where
there's no guitar.
Oh, something went wrong then with that, maybe in the email, or I played it right off the email, but we will skip.
I don't know. It sounds like it's going through some kind of compression.
Maybe it did. Maybe it did. Let's try one more way of getting to that. Just let's try the YouTube version and share again. Hold on a second. Thanks for your patience, everyone.
It's live radio, even though it's pre-recorded.
Yeah. Here we go. Let's try this.
They're criminals, our neighbors who came to raise their families, clean houses, drive trucks, and work in factories. You round them up and take them off in military planes, carrying out your solemn vow back from where they came. But why is it always the poorest of the poor are the ones upon whom we're declaring war? And what if we took back what was never really theirs? Nationalize the banks and deport the billionaires. We could liberate the capital to invest in things we need. Housing, food, and health care, they've got it all indeed. It's all wrapped up in investments and shooting to the moon. And if things go as they're going, they'll have more of it soon. But why is it always the poorest of the poor are the ones upon whom we're declaring war? And what if we took back what was never really theirs? Nationalize the banks and deport the billionaires. The rising prices that are making us all frown. If you deport our neighbors, maybe rents go down. But I've done the math, and scientists agree. If we nationalize those billions, we can all live here rent-free. And why is it always the poorest of the poor are the ones upon whom we're declaring war? And what if we took back what was never and deport the billionaires? Nationalize the banks and deport the billionaires. Nationalize the banks and deport the billionaires.
There we go. David, when did you write that one?
That was, and that's the original recording, not the one from the album, but when I just recorded it, you know, with the mandola and voice, I guess that would have been.
My name is John Riley.
Something else is playing.
No, that's my fault.
It's my dear home in Ireland. It
kept going. It was it was on YouTube and it kept going. My fault.
Uh-huh. No. Yeah, I wrote it sometime around Trump's inauguration, I guess, when they were, starting to implement their deportation proceedings, deporting all the wrong people, like usual.
I imagine songs occur to you. Do you write a song every day? My goodness, you got so much to write about these days, given your inclinations and your talents. How do you cope with every? How do you cope by writing songs, for instance? I mean, what are you going through these days?
Yeah, definitely. It's a coping mechanism. It's a form of self-therapy. It's how I cope with all the horrors in the world and try to write a song about it. Otherwise, I don't know how I'd possibly be consuming this much news if I weren't actually turning them into songs. It'd be just too overwhelming. But and it's I don't think that the times being crazy, I don't think is helpful necessarily for like material. But when there's resistance, when there's a social movement happening, when there's some kind of dynamic like that, then I find there's a lot to write about. That's what makes it easy. When there's fascists doing terrible things and people aren't reacting other than by keeping their heads down, that's not very interesting material.
Well, we'll certainly remind our DJs. You know, all of our DJs, of course, are amateurs playing for the love, the music they love, for no money. We're a nonprofit station, a low power FM, and we can play anything we want to, and we do. And I'll try to make sure that they, my partner Bob, plays your commentary sometimes.
Great.
There's plenty of commentary on the web. You're a prolific writer as well as a commentator. As well as songwriter. So we got about 8 more minutes or so. What have we not covered, David? What shall we tell people about?
Oh gosh, there's endless potential subjects out there to talk about, but I'm up for anything.
Oh, first of all, let's tell people, even though you give your way of music away and your songbook is on the web and the sheet music and so forth to encourage people playing, how would people go about paying for an album? We can't mention any prices, but is there a vehicle on your website to give you some money for your creativity?
Yeah, so as with so many other artists who lost largely our means of survival back when Spotify started their free tier, what so many of us did at that point was we turned to crowd-sourced patronage through platforms like Patreon and Substack. Patreon and Substack are the big ones. Patreon, especially for musicians, and Substack, especially for writers. But they both serve the same function of basically like in my, I mean, what a lot of people do is they put out some free stuff and others behind it paywall. What I do is I put it all out for free for anybody. But then people, just like with community radio or public radio, then people who want to support what I do, it's can then become monthly or annual supporters, be sending me a couple bucks a month or whatever it is or more. So that's how I've adapted to the loss of income from sales, because people don't buy albums anymore. They don't buy them on Bandcamp either. I mean, it's not people aren't going to just start buying albums because to support artists, but that's not a But that model doesn't work. But what does work is the ongoing support, because people don't want to just buy an album because it's going to support an artist generally. They want to have some other reason for doing it. So, and it's a roundabout way to support an artist anyway, because however you're buying the album, probably it's a platform that's taking a big cut like Bandcamp. But if you want to support an artist, the best way to do that is more directly through platforms like Patreon or Substack. Or on in my case, I do it directly on my website as well. I use all those platforms. I don't think you have to limit yourself to just one, but at davidrovics.com/subscribe, people can become support my what I do there directly. But it's the same on Substack or Patreon. It's just the same program I have set up basically, which where people can make donations. And so there's some exclusive material that I make only available for paid supporters, but the vast majority of my stuff I just give it away for everybody, and then let people pay for it if they can. And that I was doing that before, you know, Spotify as well. So that's when it was more unusual, you know. But now everybody gives away everything all the time. I mean, that's the normal thing now, you know.
I didn't know that.
Right. Yeah, I mean, if you have your if you put out music if you've been putting out music and getting it registered for digital distribution, which most artists have done, then basically when Spotify started their free tier, whether or not you signed up for it, all of a sudden all your music is available for free on Spotify. So I'm sure that's the case. If you look up, you know, just about any artist you like, John McCutcheon certainly would be among there. You'll find all his music that he's ever recorded. It's all there for free on Spotify, you know, and that's true for me, and that's true for everybody. That's why
that
nobody
books. How can that be? That you couldn't do that with printed material, right? Copyrighted material.
Well, yeah, of course, with books, I guess there's ways to do that with various sort of library apps, you know, nowadays. But it's a little bit more roundabout with books, whereas with music, it's so direct and so easy. And it's all because of Spotify. Spotify before 2013, them and the other streaming platforms, you had to pay $10 a month to access all this music. So, but it was all there, you know, everything in a very easily available form if you were willing to pay $10 a month. What changed in 2013 was that it was just now you have to listen to a few advertisements and then you get everything. So most people are willing to put up with a few advertisements to avoid paying the $10 and to avoid buying CDs. I mean, you literally now have access to like, what is it, 80 million songs, you know, that are all there, you know, 3 million artists or something, you know.
I must be paying because I never hear an ad, so... Good for me. I didn't realize I was paying.
Yeah. You're on the premium program then. Yep.
Okay, good.
It doesn't make a difference as far as the artists go. It's not like the artists make more or less money depending on whether you're paying. That's not how it's set up. But it is nice to be on the premium plan just so you don't have to listen to the ads. What they did was when they started their free thing in 2013, they just changed the payout model for all the artists. I mean, they just lowered it. You know, it's not like artists that are being heard on the premium plan get a higher payout. They never did it like that. It's just they just lowered the payout dramatically. And then Spotify got a lot bigger. I mean, so that was their, I mean, from a capitalist perspective, I guess that was their plan, was to lower their payout and then get rid of their monthly subscription thing in order to vastly grow. And they did. And, you know, they are the dominant platform in the world. So, I mean, it worked. But as far as their business model goes, but it didn't work as far as all the independent artists of the world. You know, we got screwed.
They don't give you any money when somebody plays one of your songs, or just a penny, or what? What are you? There must be something, no?
I'm in the top 3% of Spotify artists. I get with all the streaming platforms together, I'm getting more than 2 million songs streamed per year.
Wow.
And what that translates into in terms of money is less than $500 a month, which is it's not nothing, but it's a hell of a lot less than I used to make selling CDs.
Oh, good. The core, yeah. And all right. Well, I appreciate all the history and all the things you do to keep us aware of what's going on and history. For instance, the St. Patrick's Battalion. I learned history from your songs. I hope you keep writing about that too.
Oh, yeah, of course. And as far as St. Patrick's Battalion, if people don't realize, in the month of March, the entirety of Mexico is celebrating Irish music and dance and culture. And it's just amazing. There's so much great Irish music and dance in Mexico. You really, if anybody's into that kind of thing, they should go to Mexico in March.
And tell me again what the celebration is.
Well, they just love Irish music and Irish dance, and there's a lot of Mexicans who are great musicians of Irish music and Irish and great dancers doing traditional Irish dancing. But specifically, they're also all celebrating St. Patrick and the St. Patrick Battalion, the San Patricios, which for people in Mexico are well known. In the U.S., much less so. But in Ireland and in Mexico, everybody knows about them, and most people. And they're the Irish who deserted from the U.S. Army when the U.S. Army invaded Mexico in 1846, and they joined the Mexican Army, and they became the St. Patrick Battalion. They fought in 5 different battles with the U.S. Army, and most of them were killed in battle, and the rest settled in Mexico. Many were executed, and those who survived and didn't get executed, they settled in Mexico. Thousands of American soldiers deserted from the army in the course of the invasion of Mexico and settled in Mexico and became Mexican.
I did not know that.
Yeah, but 202 of them joined the Mexican army. And they were mostly Irish. There was a few Poles among them. There was an American. There was an Englishman. There was a couple of Welsh, but they were mostly Irish.
How about that? We've been talking to David Rovics, a singer-songwriter and prolific songwriter. And thank you so much, David, for being on our program today. I think I'll go out with that song about the battalion. And thank you for keeping us aware of what's happening, what has happened, history and current events. We need more of your kind of singer. And you're fearless. I know you've had a lot of grief from some of your stances, but I hope you keep on going, and we appreciate you. So,
thank you so much, Tom. Great talking to you. Thanks for the support, too.
Yeah, davidrovics.com. And here we go with St. Patrick's Battalion. Let's see. Share. Here we go.
But it's, if it happened, it wouldn't be the first time that such actions were taken by people dedicated to fighting against injustice by any means necessary. My name is John Riley. I'll have your ear only a while. I left my dear home in Ireland. It was death, starvation, or exile. When I got to America, it was my duty to go enter the army and slog across Texas to join in the war against Mexico. And it was there in the pueblos and hillsides that I saw the mistake I had made. Part of a conquering army with the morals of a bayonet blade. And there amidst all these poor dying Catholics screaming children, the burning stench of it all, myself and 200 Irishmen decided to rise to the call. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom tonight. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We marched neath the green flag of St. Patrick, emblazoned with Erin Colbra, bright with the harp and the shamrock and the Veritat Pari Publica. Just 50 years after Wolf Tone, 5,000 miles away, the Yanks called us a legion of strangers, and they can talk as they may. But from Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom tonight. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. Fought them in 5 major battles. Churubusco was the last. Overwhelmed by the cannons from Boston, we fell after each mortar blast. Most of us died on that hillside in the service of the Mexican state. So far from our occupied homeland, we were heroes and victims of fate. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom tonight. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom tonight. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.
All right, let me stop the recording and